Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. We are very excited to have our special guest in the studio. I love the way I call it the studio. Do you think anyone believes it's a studio?
It's a cupboard, basically.
Thanks, Paul.
But it is nice.
It's totally a cupboard.
You've worked on it.
Yeah, special for you.
Yeah.
Special guest, Paul Evans, former global head of media at Vodafone and now working on lots of independent projects. Welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast, Paul.
Very happy to be here. This is kind of like a rite of passage for me to a certain extent. I genuinely mean that because, you know, I was kind of leaving Vodafone about a year ago when you guys kind of started episode
yes.
one.
Yeah.
And like, I'm following in the footsteps of like, Ellie
the great and the
Gubbins
good.
Yeah. and Ray and Rob and I'm like, this is so cool.
Coming and spending 45 minutes sat in a cupboard with us.
It's what I dreamed of. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, less of the cupboard now, please.
Lindsay Rowntree, head of content at Exchange Wire. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
How's it going there?
Yeah, I'm a little bit hungover today, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, yet again, you didn't get the memo about not partying last night, did you?
I did not, no.
It's happened before.
But I was in bed early. I don't really understand what happened.
Too much beer too early on. We had for context, listeners and Paul, we had our sister publication, DTC Daily, who by the way, has had a bit of a logo rip-off from Timmy Armstrong.
Oh, yeah, Tim Armstrong,
if anyone saw his DTC business logo, it's exactly the same as ours. Anyway.
It's flattering, really.
We had a networking do with a couple of DTC brands last night, which was really fun, but I think maybe drinks were flowing too early on.
Potentially. And
the trouble is the Exchange Wire crew don't really need much encouragement and they all went down
the
wrong
path. Don't look at me when you say that.
Thinking of others.
How was everybody after the wires?
Well, now that's a good question, Paul. Yes.
I was great.
Were you?
I was fine. Well, okay, maybe not.
I was fine, tired and emotional, but you know, not too.
It was an emotional day.
That was quite immediately after watching Kieran. Like, that was tired and emotional.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. Yeah. There was. We were just talking earlier on how a couple of guests were laughing at the interaction, shall we say, between Lindsay, Kieran, and I on stage whilst we're trying to give the awards out because it's professional outfit central, isn't it? With Lindsay making announcements and then me and Lindsay shouting at Kieran to get him to hold the microphone properly. Me like elbowing Kieran in the ribs to get him to shut up, that sort of thing. Yeah.
It's the only way to manage him.
Yeah.
But was very good. Just kind of like, you know, props to you guys. It was a really brilliant event. And I thought Reggie was excellent as whatever you call him, a host, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Special guest. Yeah.
For context listeners, this is Reggie Yates.
Yeah.
Yes. Documentary filmmaker, actor,
sorry,
DJ.
I'm on first name terms.
Yeah, well, of course you are.
Of course, yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
I'm rich.
And it's like, and I think the speech on diversity within the industry is just brilliant. Well timed. It's like always.
I'm really glad that you say that. It was a bit of a departure from what we've done in previous years. We weren't quite sure how it was going to go. We had a few challenges, acoustic challenges on the evening. But I really hope that people feel like that it was interesting and they got something out of it. That's the main thing. And you're right, an important conversation to start with.
Totally.
Let's move on to the news of the week. Otherwise, like I said, we are going to be here till tomorrow. First story I wanted to chat through with you guys is a story that appeared in, I think it was called The Marketer. And it's off the back of a report from eMarketer looking at the degree to which programmatic is being used within social media. So it's talking about the volume of social media advertising that's going to be handled programmatically in the US in the coming years. And it's shifting from something like it's currently around 52% or so. It's going to shift up to 56% in the next year or two. It's talking about how that is, you know, potential reasons for this is because social media channels are obviously mobile-based channels where you're talking about an environment that doesn't rely on third-party cookie targeting. So it's kind of perfect for some of the sort of programmatic automated tools that exist in that mobile in-app environment. And what I thought was interesting about this article is it speaks to something we've started to talk about here at ExchangeWire, which is that programmatic is not a channel. Well, I know this has been being said for years, actually, but programmatic is not a channel, but rather a tool that can be applied across a number of channels. And what we're really thinking about is the degree to which we're going to start to see the proliferation of programmatic advertising in those other channels, like out of home, anything in app, anything that doesn't rely on that third party cookie environment. Because as we know, you know, reliance on that is going to diminish dramatically in the next 12 months. So that's what I thought was really interesting about this article. But I'm really keen to hear your point of view, Lindsay and Paul. Let's start with you, Paul.
Oh, that was like Russian roulette then. That's awesome.
Who's going to go with? Oh, what name would she say?
And usually I'm quite predictable, but now and then I throw in a little wild card.
She does. Now and then she chooses me. I'm like, hasn't even been listening. I've not been listening. I've not read the article. Brilliant. Thanks.
Yeah, because I think the more interesting part of the story is about definition. Absolutely. So it's, to your point, it's something that's been defined by, you know, by the name channel and format for so long, but it's so not that. And eMarketer's kind of definition is really interesting. I thought I'd kind of read it out. They define programmatic as the use of automation in the buying and selling or fulfilling of digital ads, which is so much more simple, so much more integrated in the way it kind of brings together different elements of the media ecosystem, and actually so much more meaningful. And I can say that, I guess I speak with first-hand experience from the time at Vodafone. So we arrived at a definition called Treble A Media, which was common characteristics, audience data-driven, auction-based and automated. So you can argue around the kind of nuancing it, but Treble A was a nice kind of branding. That was my idea, by the way.
Trademark claiming
that one. and what it allowed you to do was address search, social and programmatic holistically, and as I say, kind of like with integration, and it allowed you more to focus on really what programmatic is, which is about operational characteristics and operational behaviors. So for example, the way that would kind of benefit the business would be a focus more on processes and more on technology and partners and talent, where there's a bleed across, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's social programmatic. And then when you get into kind of formats or other channels like outdoor, Talon just announced today they're going into outdoor programmatic as an example. All of that becomes superfluous. It's more about the behaviours. It's more about the right objectives and the right way of kind of managing it and getting the best out of it.
Yeah. Lindsay?
I completely agree with what Paul said, and especially kind of from his background of actually having been there and done it. From my background, kind of starting my media career in paid search, kind of where it, to me, that is the original programmatic channel. And you look at kind of what programmatic actually means, and programmatic means automation, and that's what you have to focus on. And actually, even in the article talking about kind of this, the reason that social is so high is because of mobile. People that have worked in mobile teams for many years have always argued, listen, mobile is not a channel, mobile is not a format, mobile is everything and everywhere. It shouldn't be considered as a line on a media plan. Mm. It should be considered as part of everything. And that's, I think, we're still very, very caught up in what does it look like as a line on a media plan. And actually, it impacts everything. It's viable everywhere. Like, you know, mobile is TV, TV is audio, like they're all connected, and we need to think about definitions and of everything and looking at them holistically rather than trying to define something based on what budget you're going to put against it and who's going to buy it and what team it sits in. And I think that programmatic is everything, programmatic is everywhere, and actually we need to look at how we are defining that within departments, in agencies and brands everywhere, because Paul, you made a good point before we started this that display programmatic and IO teams should not be separated. They should be together. The functionalities are different, but actually there's so much crossover. There's so much bleed through from both of them. They should be both learning similar characteristics. It's actually quite sad that people in IO teams have no idea how to buy a programmatic campaign. Mm. They don't know how it works. And actually there's so many skills they should be learning here, because they are going to start coming together, and actually search and social feed into that absolutely as well. When I was working at Starcom, We definitely tried to get programmatic campaigns up and running in the search team, because we felt that we had the experience to do that. And from our experience of using AdWords, we were able to line that across to programmatic. And it made a lot of sense. But it was not well received, because it's not defined in terms of how you are managing teams and kind of like who sits where and does
what. It's
not
how things, it didn't reflect the way that the organisation and agencies set up. Yeah.
No, and things are certainly changing, and you're starting to see in certain companies that they are trying to kind of bring them all together. They're understanding that they are so similar that actually people should have these skills across everything. But that's taken many, many years, and this should have been a conversation from the very beginning, actually programmatic. Everything is bought programmatically and so on and other. It's automation.
Do you think then that, question for both of you, since we know that a sort of change is often slow, particularly within organisations, right? It's not an easy thing to do to change the way in which your organisation is set up, the way in which you've got your teams organised and arranged. And even if the theory behind it everyone's convinced of, the practicalities of doing it are often a lot slower than people would want. Do you think that this is going to be, we're going to see a bit of a collision of a few things speed that process up, which is firstly, as I mentioned, you know, an industry that can no longer rely on third party, third party cookie tracking in terms of display advertising and programmatic in general. So, you know, a sort of a flight to environments where you're not relying on cookie targeting. And then as a result of that, are you also going to see people now starting to, buyers, perhaps marketers and agencies, start to see mobile through a different lens, not a line item anymore, because actually you're going to be able to target, you perhaps always have been able to, but you're going to be willing to target a much wider audience in that environment than you ever have before. Because we've been having this conversation for about the last year or so too, the value in mobile in-app advertising for brands and marketers, which is under-realised due to the various challenges in that mobile environment. Are we going to see a collision of a few things that might create a bit more speed in terms of changing the way that agencies are set up, changing the way that teams collaborate and work together? What do you think, Paul?
Yes, it would be the very short answer. So, and I kind of love the metaphors being used in last week's podcast, the kidney dialysis one. So I'm not going to bet at that. But I think I kind of
trademark Lara. That was pretty good.
That was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
I kind of look at marketing with a kind of a front end development kind of angle, which is all about consumer experience and the delivery of that kind of magical point of connection with audiences. Where, you know, that point where you change behavior and attitudes, right? And then there's this back end of marketing. It almost feels like a pantomime horse, actually. That's really bad. And that's kind of, that's the area of focus that we're talking about here when we kind of look at kind of programmatic, really. And I think those conditional factors are absolutely going to make a difference within that area, as long as, I think, really for me, it's all about this focus on audiences and consumers at the end of the day. If we kind of realize what industry we're in, we're not in an ad tech industry, right? We're in the marketing industry. We're in the industry and we're in the business of growth through addressing audience needs. The back end and the front end of marketing gravitate around that point, and we're all doing it for the right reasons, then that's where you abandon silos. So we still need to recognize that, like, a mobile screen versus a TV screen, right?
It's different.
You know, they're very different. These nuances still exist. And when we talk about kind of homogenization underneath kind of, you know, the banner of programmatic, we're not doing away with those nuances, and they should still exist, and they will do. There's absolute differences in the way that content is consumed and needs to be displayed. But if we can kind of bring the two halves together, so we're kind of working seamlessly, that's the collision I'd like to see. As a marketer, I've seen kind of different brand people and CMOs kind of just focus on the front end, you know, that brand building, nice fluffy, kind of nice content piece. And then, you know, performance marketers are more maybe obsessed on the automation piece. Bring the two together. It's not a binary world.
Totally. Rant. Lindsay, is this going to inspire the potential to do that, do you think?
I think it will inspire it. I think that there's definitely good intentions. There are always good intentions everywhere, but it's then turning those intentions into reality that always becomes challenged, because you've got so much legacy in place, legacy infrastructure, legacy systems. It makes it challenging to do that. If you're going through the process of digital transformation, which obviously is something Vodafone did and are still going through, then it's a great opportunity to be able to do that. But there are many, many other like agencies and brands that aren't there yet, and if you're not there, it's very difficult to actually take that leap when everything is set up in a certain way.
Yeah,
but it definitely makes a lot of sense.
I dare say as well, you know, and just thinking about Vodafone, you know, it was probably one of the reasons that that reframing of programmatic, right, that collision of kind of different functions and capabilities, is probably kind of how we made in-housing work to a certain extent. Because we framed it like that, it was a common... I was kind of lucky enough to kind of build the architecture for in-housing at Vodafone, and it was a common blueprint, you know, indistinguishable by function to a certain extent, so programmatic, search, social, under the kind of common ways of working, those processes, those talent piece, the kind of roles and responsibilities that we were kind of putting in place across all the different local markets. And, you know, there was fluidity within that, but it was still born of the same ambition and the same kind of common way of working. And that's all about, you know, remove silos, single definition.
Almost. I think we had this conversation with Gerhard Lau from Deutsche Telekom when he was on the podcast.
Love Gerhard.
So do we. But what we were talking about was the notion of brands, you know, sort of using, even if not intentional, if just by proxy, in-housing as a way of change management and restructuring organisations internally.
That's so true.
That kind of hanging that principle on the notion of in-housing.
But yeah, going down a path of in-housing for cost is literally kind of crazy by definition. You know, it's a 2 to 5 year kind of investment. It's about capability building over the longer term, knowledge acquisition, and really understanding your audiences better and being able to market better. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It is a change management thing.
Cool. I'm going to change gears and move us on to the second news story, which is I wanted to return to Lara O'Reilly from DigiDay's piece on the ICO's AdTech Fact-Finding Forum last week. We talked about it briefly in the podcast last week, but the reason I wanted to return to it was just to have a little bit more of a detailed conversation on this from the perspective of brands and marketers now that we've got Paul in the room.
What a coincidence. What a happy joy.
So well planned. And so for the benefit of listeners, just to recap on what this was the ICO hosting a specific forum to discuss in a little bit more detail their updated findings on their RTB report that they released in June. So this is them going into a bit of detail about what they think about various RTB protocols and practices with respect to how that measures up to GDPR and potential privacy legislation that's coming down the line. Their position is that they feel that there are still parts of the ad tech industry that are contravening the intended laws that are underpinned by GDPR. They're very clear about the fact that they will be taking anyone to task that is continuing to do so, that's not changing any of their practices. And specifically, they were focusing on things like special category data and sensitive data, the sharing of that and the protocols that are used and the mechanisms that are used within bid requests to sort of share and access that data. They're not happy with them. They still don't feel that they're necessarily being, that those tasks are being undertaken properly. They invited in a Chatham House rules style session a number of key players in the industry together, Google, IAB, various ad tech industry executives, some lawyers and some privacy campaigners, and apparently also some brands. We noted last week that we weren't really aware of any publishers being involved. Maybe they were. We're not sure. So, you know, it was interesting having the conversation with Lara last week. She was talking about from the point of view of publishers. But I guess I'm really interested to know what your perspective is on this really important issue from a brand's point of view, Paul, because okay, they were in the room, but we don't really have much of a conversation about the impact that any of this has on brand marketers and what they're doing in a day-to-day capacity.
Yeah, what is the conversation they are having?
Exactly.
We don't have any visibility.
To what extent do they feel involved in this conversation, and to what extent do they feel it's relevant to their tasks?
Speaking on behalf of my fellow marketers, is that where we go? I'm representing the entire industry right now.
Yes.
No pressure. Basically. Awesome. And I may go on a mild Kieran style rant.
Yes, you did warn us.
We'll see how we go.
We're expecting coarse language could possibly enter this as well.
For sure.
Continue.
Because I kind of look at GDPR a little bit and you know, all of this effort being taken around consent and privacy a little bit in the way that kind of the industry talks about ad fraud. If you kind of mention ad fraud, it's almost a soundbite. It's just a throwaway comment, and nobody appears to be taking it seriously, or seriously in the right way. So what I mean about, like, Adform is like the second most valuable kind of organized crime behind drug trafficking, as an example. It's a real thing for marketers, because we're like funding this whole show, basically. Yeah. I think, you know, data management and privacy and consent is kind of the same thing for me to a certain extent. What I mean by that is, I don't think we've taken it seriously, and seriously in the right way. So let me kind of delve in on that a little bit. Have to help me out. So what I mean by that is, we kind of have focused on risk mitigation, which I know that's what GDPR is all about. As a technical framework, that's what it's all about. But actually, it feels as though we've missed, as audiences do, we focus on the audience, right? We focus on our consumers and the experience, the best experience we can give them. We haven't seemed to have kind of gone down that road of trust and transparency. We haven't thought about, well, instead of how to avoid a fine, why don't we just kind of like try and fix the problem?
Think about doing this better.
And start again. We're an industry that's paying for our mistakes, right? From like years ago. Like, online advertising is like 25 years old now. And it was a small industry to start off with. And I think kind of, you know, lots of things were not given due attention right then, right? User experience and probably kind of data privacy and consent management and so on like that. Now we're big, we're kind of like too big to fail to a certain extent, or too big to fix, it feels like. Mm. And you kind of, I don't know, I'm quite a principled guy as a marketer, and you know, at Vodafone we put operating principles at the heart of the way we went to market, the way we engaged with our suppliers and partners, the way we made decisions. And if you start with principles, if you start with trust and transparency as your beginning, then surely you just avoid all of this, what is now inevitable regulation and you know, and punitive action. It's going to get really tough for people. It could have been so much easier. This thing has been going on for like 2017, right? Just from a legislative point of view. Mm. And we're still here now, kind of doing things in increments, not really changing the game for the benefit of the, you know, of the user and the user experience. It's a slightly simplistic, and I mentioned earlier, I kind of hate binary thinking, right? Like binary thinking in silos, it's kind of like one of the worst habits and behaviors within the industry. But when you actually start with principles, it's probably the only time where binary kind of counts, because it's just about doing the right thing. This is one of those things where people just have to face up to the fact they've built a business on like quicksand and it needs fixing for the benefit of the industry going forwards. You know,
do you think, I'm going to come to you in a second, Lindsay, but do you think, Paul, that the reason that marketers perhaps could be forgiven for not taking this seriously is because, specifically in this particular instance, some of the stuff that regulators are looking at is such fine detail within the mechanics that are powering things like personalized advertising that they don't feel it's relevant to them. So that they think, okay, they might agree with your sentiments, but they might think, yeah, but we're not the people that can fix this RTB stuff, because that's over to the tech vendors. It's got nothing to do with us.
And to be clear,
we're not responsible in that sort of melee of who has what data and is transferring it where.
Yeah, no, and to be clear, so marketers should take ownership, right? And in the way that kind of we set out those operating principles, that's a way of taking ownership over, you know, over the outcomes, the right outcomes for the business and right outcomes for audience. But really, the problem sits with kind of ad tech and martech and that wonderful value chain that's been built to, I was going to say exploit, but to, you know,
Danny Spears calls it? Opacity by design.
Yeah, Danny's absolutely right. It's been designed that way. And the industry now needs to kind of face up. So I really am kind of talking about the rest of the industry in terms of those people, those those actors within the industry taking ownership and responsibility for change going forwards.
Yeah, but you know, clearly and rightly saying that in part needs to be sort of motivated by, empowered by brand marketers who are saying this needs to be done the right way.
Yeah,
otherwise we won't be
voting with our wallets and other means of kind of bringing that that pressure to bear on the issue is absolutely the way forward on something as critical as this.
Yeah, Lindsay. Who's responsible? Is anyone taking responsibility?
Not really.
Yeah.
Not really. Mm. I think GDPR, and Paul, you talk about the way that GDPR is talked about versus the same way that ad fraud is talked about. In my view, it's just a giant eye roll. Like, I think of GDPR as everyone sort of goes, oh, God, really? Mm. Are we still talking about this? It's like, I think the worry about what GDPR is doing to the marketing industry, not just the ad tech industry, marketing industry in general, is that it's causing us to be scared to be really future facing now. We're worried about looking too far ahead to what can happen because everyone sort of thinks that the industry is going to crumble tomorrow and they're not really sure what's going on. So everyone's just kind of like still going through the motions, thinking any day now someone can knock on my door and could say, we're going to fine you $10 billion. And I don't think anyone really kind of knows what tomorrow brings, and that kind of worries people. So everyone just kind of just thinks, well, we'll just live for the here and now and see what happens. We'll still try and exploit as much as we can and we'll just carry on. But I think this industry is too big not to be regulated. Like we've managed to get away with it for a long time, not really having any regulation.
Yeah, agree.
The next stage of that is trying to actually find something that's globally standardized when it comes to regulation.
Yeah.
And so GDPR is a great starting point. But GDPR in Europe still means that there are companies that are going, US companies are going, well, we've got a new product launching next year, but we probably won't roll it out in Europe because it's just too complicated with GDPR.
Yeah, like it's optional.
Yeah, we'll go to APAC first because they don't give a shit what's going on. And we'll do the US apart from California because that's just too complicated. And that's what companies are looking at now. It's like, well, thanks very much. Sorry, guys. But it's making our jobs in Europe much harder for a start. But also it's kind of making you think, well, it still means that people don't want to look at the regulation as something positive. They're looking at it as something, how can I avoid regulation? I'll just go to APAC instead. Great for APAC, massive growth opportunity for APAC, for outside companies, outside investments. But Europe is kind of just left languishing for now.
Also, I think that it'll be interesting to see how that strategy pans out, even in the US, because remember, Lindsay, we had this conversation with Dennis Buckheim from IAB Tech Lab. It's not just California where you're seeing privacy legislation come to the forefront. Actually, there's millions of pieces of legislation that's unfolding across lots and lots and lots of different states in the US. That's effectively a bit of a mirror image of the California legislation. Actually, what they were hoping is a mirror image, but a sort of a tightened up version, because the California legislation was brought forward privately to start with by a private individual, and now they want something a little bit more sophisticated that can be rolled out in other states.
Yeah, I think it needs to be federal.
Right. And so there's a kind of grappling with what that might look like. And I sort of think anyone that's building a business on the basis of running away from legislation is only going to be able to go so far. And maybe they don't care. Maybe
it's short-term myopia, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And maybe that short-termism will yield lots of cash up positive results for some individuals, but it won't be the sort of stuff that has got any longevity, not least because the legislators might catch up with them, but also because I think the rest of the industry is, you know, whether it's as a result of being forced to change or whether it's as a result of them really confronting themselves in the mirror and kind of going, okay, we need to grow up now. We need to create a little bit more of a mature industry. We need to be, you know, we've got marketers breathing down our necks saying we're not spending our ad dollars here unless we really know what's happening with all of the data that's involved in this chain.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah. Mm. And so maybe it really will be a different place in another 12 months' time. Once we've seen, the ICO are very clear about the fact that they will be issuing fines. And, you know, they can't talk about these things in much detail because you're talking about potential legal cases being brought forward. But even when they're on stage at ATS in London, in the prep for that, Ali Shah, who I chatted with, he said, look, make no mistakes, we're really busy doing some stuff behind the scenes that we can't talk about because lawyers are involved. Like, so it only needs for a couple of big examples to come forward for people to then think, okay, this is too much of a risk for us to continue taking.
What's your impression of how the ICO has gone about it? I mean, what I've heard within the industry is that they've taken quite a positive and a considered stance. They've engaged the industry quite well. You know, they were inviting kind of one-to-one conversations a little while back. I understand they're kind of now really trying to channel things through the IAB. I mean, I think I kind of quite like that consultative process, but equally, because of that inertia, because of that myopic kind of stance that people can take, it's time for action. It's time for somebody to really like regulate, genuinely regulate and set the rules down in terms of what's in and what's out. Do you think?
I think they're going to do that. Yeah? I do think that they're going to lay the law down. I don't think we should underestimate them. I think people make the mistake of thinking, it's kind of a government agency. They've not got much resources. They're serious. We know that they know what they're talking about, but are they really going to actually follow it up with some action? I think they will.
Yeah, and they're the most tooled up DPA in Europe.
Yeah. So I think don't underestimate them by any stretch of the imagination. And also because we know that some of the staff there have come from tech backgrounds as well. So they do know what they're talking about. Mm. And they're at least passionately interested enough to make sure they're getting to the bottom of the matter. I absolutely encourage a consultative approach. My personal opinion is that they haven't consulted wide enough. Mm. And that would be the thing that concerns me.
I agree.
I'm not concerned about them channeling things through the IRB. That's absolutely right and appropriate. And the IRB is rightly set up for that, and I think that's great. But I think they've relied too heavily on the views of a couple of individuals or organisations, And you've got you've got a closed forum where some of the key players are Google and a few ad tech execs. We don't know who they were because press weren't invited.
Yeah.
And maybe that it was really representative. But let's make no bones about this. Google have got an absolute vested interest in how all of this shakes out. So we need to make sure that view is being balanced. And maybe it is being balanced. This is just my personal opinion, Lindsay.
Yeah. I guess we are not getting that much read into what the conversations are. No. We're just hearing things anecdotally. Mm. So. And anecdotally, things aren't particularly positive. Like anecdotally, the outcome of that recent meeting with the ICO, everyone was like, yeah, it was a good meeting. Okay, great. Well, that's really helpful. Like, actually, we don't know what the next steps are from that. Everything is happening now, but it's now a bit like a juggernaut. Like everything's happening too quickly, too close to the wire.
And
should have been happening 2 years ago.
And at a kind of crazy time, right? So they're releasing a further update on their RTB report on the 20th of December. You tell me.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
And who is going to be sitting there on the 21st of December going, shit, have we got the house in order? Like, who are they? Who's going to be around working? Our lovely, friendly Jewish community in New York, maybe, because they're not preparing themselves for Christmas. But I just think that's crazy timescale, right? Anyway,
it is ridiculous.
Now we're disappearing down a rabbit hole, and I'm chief ranter. So
yeah,
let's move
this
on.
You've set Rachel off now, Paul. Yeah.
Oh, no, this is awesome. I love it.
It's only because I wanted a closer relationship with the ICO.
Really
but anyway,
we really do. Yeah.
So let's move on to the third news story that I want to talk about, which is an article that you shared on LinkedIn earlier on in the week, Paul, which is a really good in-depth article. Correspondent.
Yeah, we'll go with that.
That's it. On the notion, discussing and debating, and had quite a lot of research, detailed research involved in it too, discussing and debating the notion of the online or digital advertising industry being the new dot-com bubble. So they talked about some really interesting, they interviewed a whole load of people that are previous execs at advertising technology companies and
economists.
Media companies.
They brought economists into play.
They brought economists into this.
Economists are like heat-seeking missiles. They're absolutely awesome people.
They were really serious about some of the stuff they put in this.
Yeah, they apply a different lens to kind of how we need to think about measurement. And I think that's kind of endemic in the story is really interesting.
Absolutely. And I think that's what the article mostly focused on for me was, the fact that the advertising industry's got a measurement issue. We all know that. That's not news. But to what extent is that going to define the way that brands interact with advertising going forward are some of the things that were in my mind. I really liked this thing that they defined as selection effect. So the argument being, they were taking some examples. eBay was one of the brands that they noted as an example, who were looking at the amount of money that they were spending on search-based advertising and wondering whether that advertising was actually working because they were targeting people that wouldn't have visited eBay otherwise, or whether actually that was just being, those were results that people were clicking on who were on their way to eBay anyway. Mm. And if you think about it, that's the big question mark that shadows the entire industry. How does advertising work?
Advertising per se, that's not just a digital thing.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Advertising but across the board.
The interesting thing for me is the digital industry, the digital advertising industry set itself up to benefit from selection, from the selection effect, right? You know, in the article it talks about, it's Eric Schmidt, isn't it, from Google. Our business is highly measurable. We know that if you spend X dollars on ads, you'll get Y dollars in revenues. You pay only for what works. I mean, literally...
Bold statements, right?
No selection effect. It's all the benefit of the advertising and the ad dollars you spend with us. Complete bullshit.
And when did he say that, though,
2003.
Paul? That's what I was thinking. Right? Early days, right?
This has set the tone for the way that the whole digital ad industry has worked, right? Because we've got, you know, most of the digital ad industry kind of focuses on the bottom of the funnel, right? And, you know, and performance actions and metrics wrong in the first place. And you know, all of it has kind of set those expectations for marketers as well. Whole breed of marketers kind of grown up, growth hackers and platform marketers, you know, they're sitting in a WeWork now having a flat white with headphones on. And, you know, these guys don't really, I think they've lost sight of what really is happening within kind of, you know, digital advertising, in as much as there's a bigger holistic kind of customer journey that happens. And we need to be measuring the total effect of advertising across that customer journey. We need to be doing total customer journey management.
Yep.
Not, again, goes back to silos and binary thinking. If you kind of, you know, make that division between the two, you get bad outcomes at the end of the day.
What did you think of this article, Lindsay? Is it, you know, is it... telling us what we already know about the flaws in the digital advertising model, or is it actually a sort of a call to arms for thinking about the ways in which we measure what we're doing in digital advertising, not necessarily just the effectiveness of it, but what we're doing and how we're doing it?
I think most of us would read that and go, yeah, that figures, like, yeah, that's absolutely what I expected to read. Like, it's obviously, because we none of us really believe our own hype when it comes to digital advertising, yeah. I think largely. Also, I think the measurement angle is an interesting one, because it does highlight that we do need to look at things differently. And it's about getting away with things for as long as you can before someone goes, okay, things need to change now. Mm. But as we were just talking about with GDPR, something kind of systemic has to come into play for everyone to go, okay, right, this is now the new normal. This is how we now measure the industry. And, like, you know, is this industry a dot-com bubble potentially? It's how do you make money out of the internet? Like, things are marginal, right? And actually there should be no margins to this industry, but it turns out there are margins everywhere, and margins on margins on margins. And actually the measurability of the industry, when you take the margins out of it, just becomes more and more complicated. And I think that we should be looking at this in a way of, okay, there's a lot more we can do with this. There's a lot more we can understand about how the industry fits together if we just increase the conversation between all these different moving parts. And that's what we still don't do. Mm. And Google have created an industry out of not being transparent in what's measured, what you have access to, what we can see versus what you can see. That's literally been their business model for the past however many decades, years. And that's translated to everywhere else across the industry as well. So everyone kind of knows what
they followed their lead.
Yeah, everyone knows what you know, but there's so much out there that you don't know, and you sort of go, well, you're probably happily sort of going, well, I don't need access to that. Actually, you probably do, and we should all be having access to the same information. It would make it everything a lot more sensible.
Mm.
That was a weird rant. I don't know what I was
talking about. Mature.
That's good.
No, I can't. I do see where you're coming from. What I would like to know from you, Paul, is where do you see, you know, I think probably around this table we would maybe, well, I don't know, I'm, you know, can't speak for everybody, but I would imagine that we'd say it's not a dot-com, online advertising is not a dot-com bubble, because online or digital advertising isn't going to go away. However, flaws across measurement, flaws within measurement across the advertising industry, not just digital, is definitely something that the industry needs to face up to. So I don't know what your view on that is, Paul, but yeah. I want to know that, and also where you see this going. Therefore, you know, if we accept that actually there are some fundamental flaws in the way the system is set up, and that we might see brands pulling budgets from various sources because they're not convinced of the uplift they're getting, well, to what end? Where does that then take us? Where does that then take the industry? Particularly given that, you know, I think we all accept that advertising is the thing that funds other businesses, right? It's the thing that pays for publishers' content, both online and anywhere else, you know. So if there is to be a thriving advertising industry that's based more on reality and less on smoke and mirrors, what would that look like? And is that what brands want as well?
Good shout. Good questions. So, you know, I think brands at the end of the day want better measurement. They want better targeting, better planning opportunities. And I think if the industry can move beyond this, again, it comes back to kind of myopia and binary thinking. If we can kind of recognize that there is value within digital advertising, within online advertising, across the entire customer journey, that there's different roles for different channels and formats within that, there's a natural obsession, I think, within the industry around identity, right? That you guys have spoken about this in the past. And, you know, I've seen Ofcom ICO research on this, which says actually kind of, you know, identity and the implications of kind of, or the benefits, alleged benefits of that as expressed as personalization, don't necessarily kind of enamor users and audiences. You know, once you're showed kind of what does identity mean and where does that identity data come from, audiences aren't, you know, that enthralled by kind of personalization. And you kind of think maybe there's a, you know, I'd love to see us look at serendipity, you know, as a kind of weird and wonderful kind of way of targeting it. Serendipity is exactly how outdoor works, and outdoor is econometric kind of studies are proving that outdoor is one of the most effective channels out there. It works through surprise, it works through delight and chance. You know, we don't have to target the shit out of people that the online advertising kind of industry kind of does a lot of the time within the kind of way it works. I'd love to see the industry kind of take a step back, look at, you know, focus on the audience, focus on marketers and what marketers need across the customer journey, and develop solutions that reflect that without this kind of, you know, single-minded view that it's all about kind of performance and attribution, because it's not true, you know, and the eBay kind of examples, you know, really bear that out.
Yeah, I think you do it because you have to, because Google tells you have to, and because everyone else is doing it, and you're going, everyone else is doing it, I haven't got a choice. Mm. And the eBay example is a great one. And it's like, well, why should I have to bid on my brand keyword? I'm already there.
I've got a big brand. Everybody knows who I am. I'm already there.
Why do I? And then obviously competitors start bidding on your brand. So then you have to start paying more to kind of just be the top of your own brand. You shouldn't have to be there. But Google say, well, you probably pay to cover your, are you covering your brand? That's...
And they're making it harder and harder, aren't they?
Yeah, and then they're blend that into attribution as well. So actually, if I'm using brand keywords as well as generic keywords, and then I've got attribution shows that search is the most powerful tool, that instantly is more money into search. Because yes, generic in isolation wouldn't work, but you combine generic and brand together, then obviously my attribution's through the roof. Search wins on last click, and many people still using last click. So search gets even more of the ad dollars. And then we're looking at other aspects as well. That then feeds into display. Oh God, people are starting to display. I should probably do the same thing. And Google's telling me I should do, and other companies with a vested interest are telling me I should do, so I will do. Oh, they're doing it. I better follow suit as well. And that's how this industry just grows and grows and grows. Mm. And I like the serendipitous kind of idea about that, because actually search is the exact bloody opposite. Mm. Like, you've already got a captive audience. In what world do you have, I'm searching for a keyword and all of the ads and everything on the page that appears is exactly what I'm looking for. All of the, like, 12 ads on a page that are all dedicated to the one keyword I'm already searching for. Do I need that as a consumer? No. But Google's told the advertiser that the consumer needs that. The consumer needs to see advertising that's relevant, because SEO isn't good enough. And obviously SEO doesn't bring Google money. And so from that perspective, the advertiser kind of is led to believe that that's where they have to be to get the consumer. And actually, at what point has that ever been true or necessary?
And
not to like completely say that advertising is pointless, because I love this industry.
But it's hot.
Because otherwise, what are we going to talk about on the Mad Tech podcast?
It's my
Lindsay.
Life. But it's a fair point, though. Like, we're doing it because we've been told we had to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
It has a role to play within. So advertising is just one small part of marketing, right?
And
so
100%.
Marketing as a, you know, as a strategic driver, driving innovation and, you know, and positioning of the product in kind of consumers' minds and something like that. You know, but advertising is, it's really hard to change attitudes and behaviors just through an image or kind of a piece of video really difficult. So don't underestimate how hard it is and what the industry's done to kind of overcompensate then is kind of say, oh, actually, it really does work, because they've kind of focused in on that kind of zero moment of truth, you know, that last click piece. Whereas actually they've just overstated it. That's a lot of what the kind of the bubble analogy premise draws was. Attention to, right? Mm. Is this overstatement of effect. Mm. And nobody wants to walk away from that. And to answer the other part of your question around kind of what a marketer's going to do, you know, the article really calls out the inertia that exists within the industry. Again, God, there's repeating themes, you know, with GDPR and so on like that. It's nobody wants to do anything. Nobody wants to stick their neck out.
You move when you're pushed.
Yeah. And nobody wants to say, you know, what's gone before is wrong. Or even like, I don't know. I don't know is such a powerful thing. Mm. It should lead people to then go on and question, you know, with integrity. Mm. And, you know, there's so many businesses with a conflict of interest within that value chain that they're not going to raise those questions.
They're not going to be the people to question.
Mm. Nuh-uh.
So I'm going to use this theme to move on to breaking with convention, discussing one more news story before we kind of launch into talking a bit more about what you're up to, Paul. But this is also connected to that. And that is an article that came out this week that Allbirds, who are the DTC shoe brand in the US, got cross with Amazon for copying one of their products. I think it was a wool sneaker or a wool shoe.
So Allbirds are famous for their sustainable wool footwear.
That's right, yes. And Amazon, they believe, copied, and they allege, copied directly one of their designs, started selling it on their marketplace, obviously completely undercutting them for a significantly cheaper price. And Allbirds took to, as well as probably doing other things, took to social media to try to shame them into admitting that they don't use sustainable products to create these shoes. So kind of so many things going on in that, but that are slightly connected to what we're just talking about, right? Yeah. Like not a classic advertising channel, but social increasingly used for something that is almost like a proxy to advertising.
Yeah.
Quite positive PR in many respects for Allbirds, quite kind of negative PR in some respects for Amazon, except for that if people have now discovered that Amazon, if they didn't already know that Amazon copycat products, then they might start flocking to Amazon to look for other copycat products.
Come on, they're Teflon. I mean, you can go at them as much as you like.
And nothing happens. Okay, exactly, nothing happens. So there's so much going on in there, but it just strikes me, listening to what you were just talking about as well, Paul, the sort of marketer's perspective and the brand's perspective on how they navigate their way through this advertising world. DTC brands or challenger brands are just perfectly set up for perhaps being the people that could stick their neck out a little bit here and do things a bit differently.
Mm.
But then are they hamstrung by other forces within their part of the world, such as hugely dominant e-commerce marketplaces, where they feel like perhaps they've little choice but to participate in those marketplaces, but then when they do, they risk somebody ripping their products off? Is that, is that a reason for them to start deviating from those marketplaces and going, actually, no, we're not selling our brands here like Nike did recently? Or is this just a good example of, I think you might maybe mentioned it in the lead up to this when we were sharing ideas before the podcast, is this just an example of flattery, competition being a form of flattery? Like,
yeah. I just think it was the wrong response, genuinely. So there's stories within stories within this one. It was
exactly.
Such a good one to kind of put on the table as a marketer kind of looking at it, because they should have just, if they believe in themselves as a brand, if they believe that they've built a brand, then they should be confident of being able to withstand what is effectively, you know,
competition.
An attack and competition, natural competition as well. So own label is endemic in pretty much most categories, right? If you go into Tesco's and Sainsbury's, you know, if you're a grocery brand, you're kind of very used to it. Parallel would be someone like Unilever and Dove. Dove is just a soap, right? It's a commodity in effect. But they have focused on brand building over decades, right? And building that brand over time to justify and qualify and position that price premium for that product in the consumer's mind, right? They've got no worries about own label. I mean, within a certain extent, right? Everybody's aware of their competitive set, but they know their
place. Ultimately they're confident in their brand, right? They know
absolutely.
That's, yeah.
Whereas, you know, and so what this article kind of said to me was like, A, be flattered. Like, it is flattery, right? It says you're doing something right within the marketplace. You know, B, what the fuck? You know, don't react like that. That's just crazy. Mm. They should have just addressed this in a different way. And I think C, kind of, you know, what do you expect if you're going to build your brand on a platform? Mm. I don't know who kind of to attribute the quote to, you know, but I've heard that one before about not building your brand on platforms. And it makes a lot of sense, because in the end, you'll get shafted, inevitably so. And Nike, great example that you raised there, have, you know, recognized that. They, you know, again, they're a brand built over decades. So they have that to fall back on. They have, you know, they've positioned themselves in consumers' minds incredibly well. When I mentioned I work in China earlier on before the podcast, that's who I was working with. Just one of the most amazing brands on this planet in terms of understanding its audiences. And they manage their distribution really well. They know they can be as much a friend as a competitor. And, you know, they're kind of retrenched away from Amazon into, you know, supporting their own kind of dot-com business is the right thing, you know? Mm. Absolutely.
What do you think, Lindsay? I mean, because you know, I'd have thought that Allbirds, like many other DTCs, were using lots of different avenues to try to build their brand, which were the exact same avenues that they were probably using for customer acquisition, thus turning up on platforms. But so is that a mistake? I don't know. What's your point of view, Lindsay?
I guess it's not a mistake if you're using it for acquisition purposes only. But as Paul rightly said, it is a mistake if you're then trying to build a brand out of it, because you will get shafted. And Amazon is so good at shafting people. Like it's sport for them, I think. But I mean, Allbirds are pushing the fact that their footwear is sustainable. Their footwear is also expensive. So if you're looking for something that is sustainable, breathable, whatever else, and everything you want from an Allbirds shoe, they're supposed to be insanely comfortable, fantastic if you can afford them. Amazon and many other companies like Amazon are very good at mimicking products that are, you know, if they're aspirational. Allbirds is an aspirational product now. Actually, if you can't afford that, but you want to be able to afford something like it, then you would go and buy something similar. There's tons of copies out of everything everywhere. Adidas have problems with it. Nike have problems with it. Like it's an issue, but also it is flattering.
Reality.
Yeah, it is reality.
Yeah.
And so you deal with it by not throwing your toys out of the pram, basically.
Getting a little less cross.
Yeah, well, you have to appreciate that is a reality, and you've done enough to build a brand over a very short amount of time. You've got flagship stores in big cities, so you're a direct consumer brand that has built enough of an audience and enough data that you're now going into physical store locations. You know, you've made it, guys. So just accept that in making it, but also having a product that is limiting, the people are going to try and copy you. And I think you have to accept it. And other DTC brands have the same thing. They only exist on platforms. So in only existing on platforms and not having the capacity to build a brand outside of those platforms, they are shafted, and they don't last very long, because they then have to kind of work out, what do I do now? I should probably invest in some TV or out of home, because actually I can't build a brand on Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah, if you can build a business in like 6 months, it can be dismantled in 6 months as well. With
or
those,
even quicker.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this goes one other kind of part of the story, I think, with Allbirds, because I think actually Allbirds is actually a nice brand. They've actually, it's one I would probably say a DTC business that has built a brand, like Eve as well.
I agree.
So I think they've kind of put some effort in. They use kind of other media outside of Instagram.
Social channels.
Yeah, social channels. So I think they've taken strides. So hence why I would have said, you know, a different response would have made a lot of sense for them. A more confident response, a response which, you know, recognizes that mental positioning that they've kind of built in audiences' minds. But really, and I know you guys have a vested interest in DTC, obviously, with your sister publication, right? But you know, I look at DTC brands with fascination. It's a really, really interesting part of the marketplace. And I think with envy, a lot of industries and a lot of brands like Unilever buying kind of Dollar Shave Club and so on like that have kind of thought there's some kind of secret sauce over there. Not really. And actually, you look under the skin. Well, the secret sauce is they understand audiences, customers, use data and technology incredibly well to manage that customer journey, right? So that's their secret sauce. That still, though, isn't building a brand. That is just systems and processes. working efficiently to manage that journey.
And being more unified, I suppose, which is what we were talking about before. And maybe it's because you're a smaller business.
Correct.
But you're building it from that point of view, right? Trying to have that unified view of the customer journey right from the get-go.
Yeah. I don't believe either. Unilever, for example, buying Dollar Shave Club, they're doing it because they see something there that they want their own business. Because I don't think that can translate into the behemoth that is Unilever. Mm. You buy this much smaller company and then go, okay, we're now going to turn into Dollar Shave Club model. And, you know, we heard actually at our DC London event this year, a guy, a former Unilever employee, who said, we are not allowed to go near Dollar Shave Club. It's called a speedboat internally.
Yeah.
And because we are not a speedboat, we're an oil tanker. We can't touch it. Like, we can't mess with the formula and do anything that could Unileverize it and potentially ruin it. So we are not allowed to go near it, like look at the data or anything. Wow. I think they're required to be taken out of the market, not for any other real reason.
But I guess where I was going to go with this is that I think there's a lot of DTC businesses which haven't built brands, that they haven't invested.
Thousands
of them that haven't built brands. And those are the ones, if they're looking at this story, that should feel at risk. Those are the ones that should feel vulnerable.
Because Amazon's coming for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Own Label will come for you. Absolutely. Or copycats, you know, from China or wherever, you know, absolutely they'll come for you. And it's in everybody's interests to build a brand over time. That is, it's one of the, it feels as though it's one of the lost arts of marketing that's been sacrificed at the expense of rapid, scalable growth. You know, it feels kind of quite crazy to me after kind of 20 years as a marketer to then see this happening. But then there's no shortcuts to kind of building a brand. There's no shortcuts to really kind of sustainable growth, which is the difference, I think, with these businesses. And you kind of worry that they're all going to come crashing down if they haven't kind of made those right investments in the right channels, addressing audiences in the right way to build that brand.
Yeah, I think it feels like... you know, I almost want to fast forward 5 years from now and just know a little bit about what will happen to some of these DTC businesses, because they're fascinating. They're doing things so completely differently from the way, you know, other brands might have done things before. And, you know, I really want to see them grow and thrive, but I've got no idea what that landscape's going to look like, you know, not even in 12 months, let alone 5 years. How many will still be here? What will it have done to the way that we consume things? Because that's the thing I think is also really interesting. It's creating a little bit of a revolution in the way that consumers interact with products and the way that we buy stuff and the way that we shop for stuff. Yeah. And I think that's really fascinating too.
Yeah. And it's the parallel, I guess, with B2B marketing and the work that I'm doing right now, I guess, as I look to D2C and B2C, B2B. They're making the same mistakes to a certain extent. The issues within the marketplace around brand building and marketing are very similar. Short-termism, in terms of, or a focus on short-term, a focus on rationality, narrow targeting as opposed to kind of, you know, wide reach, whilst remaining relevant kind of addressability. All of those things are going to hinder any DTC brand that is going to seek growth in the future, because they're on shaky ground, really. They haven't done the necessarily groundwork that they should have done.
Mm. So tell us a bit more about who you're working with or what you're doing at the moment, what you're working on, Paul. You've got a few things, a few irons in the fire.
You make me sound like Del Boy or something like that.
I didn't mean in a used car salesman kind of way.
No, that's cool. this is the therapy session of the podcast, right?
I think. Definitely. Tell us about your life.
So 20-year marketer and left Vodafone, kind of the archetypal corporation, and wanted to pivot my career into kind of into something more entrepreneurial, I guess. And it's still, you know, to a certain extent, still looking for that and kind of looking for that longer term gig. But the way I transitioned out of Vodafone was into project work. And I guess, you know, I had sat on the other side of the table for 3 or 4 years. I'd seen hundreds of ad tech and martech pitches across the ecosystem. I kid you not. DSPs, ad servers, analytics, DMPs, bid management, the works. And you kind of felt, another similar presentation, all rational, you know, those same kind of, you know, observations that I was making around the DTC world. You know, just focus on the short term, just focus, you know, on kind of, you know, narrow definitions of kind of market needs and so on like that. And I felt as though, as a marketer, with that knowledge of marketing and marketers as a kind of addressable audience, I could help. It sounds quite altruistic and kind of quite noble. It's it clearly not meant to be that, but I'll fix the industry one project at a time.
I like kind of it. Thing.
Yeah, that could be my
our hero, Paul.
That could
Evans,
be my tagline.
Like
yeah. Oh, ad tech personality of the year.
Oh, there
I'm
we
starting,
go. 2020.
Starting
the campaign.
Yeah, magical year 2020. So I started kind of doing project work and was very well received, and I've been lucky enough to kind of work with some great businesses this year, businesses like Adform and Effective, in helping them develop their strategies and their core business strategies and the way that they market them. So, and also kind of grounding all that or couching all that, there's this elevation of marketing that I genuinely believe in within the B2B world. It's typically seen as like the colouring in department, which is, it's, you know, so downstream, and it's just about kind of press releases and some events and stuff like that. Marketing, you know, any ad tech, martech business out there right now, you look at the Lumascape, you go to Demexco, it's a commodity marketplace. I've never seen a more perfect economy for marketing, which is about distinction and differentiation and really being able to punch through. And it's that kind of elevation of marketing that I'm looking to kind of build with the clients and businesses that I'm working with and thoroughly enjoying it. Adform is a great example, you know. Love those guys. I know them really, really well. Lovely kind of Danish, German business. Really human business.
With a good few Brits in there as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for good measure.
Yeah. Love Ollie.
I was about to say Ollie Whitten, yeah.
And Rick. And so brilliant people, and I work with them at Vodafone as well. And you know, we were working on their value proposition, and from inherently a business, you know, that was, you know, not a criticism in any way, was focused on the benefits of technology. We've kind of worked on a value proposition now, which is much more about the human layer of what they do, because they are brilliant partners. They've got a brilliant service layer, a brilliant kind of position to the industry as partners, and that's where their new VP, their new value proposition is kind of taking them, expressed, you know, with clear purpose and some really strong language that helps again kind of elevate and
get
makes
their message through.
Yeah, different in the marketplace.
And so are you mostly working with tech companies in order to refine their propositions, or are you finding yourself working with others as well?
Agencies and yep. consultancies as well. I yep. like to spread myself about the industry where I can. But enjoy it, you know, like I've been quite critical and kind of hard on the industry in this kind of conversation today, I guess, you know, but it's genuinely meant with some kind of love and affection, because 20-year marketer, love marketing. I so enjoyed my time at Vodafone. You know, when you're kind of working within a business with such scale and influence within the marketplace, to be able to develop practice based on principles. And, you know, we took the lead on kind of brand safety and verification, on you know, on ad tech stack management, and on in-housing. We made a real difference in the way we went about it. And, you know, I kind of wanted to be able to carry that through the work that I'm doing now, and thoroughly enjoying the kind of all of the different problems, different problems that kind of looking to solve.
And looking at them from a different point of view, right? And that, so that must be interesting, you know, coming into companies, the likes of AdForm or any other tech companies that you've worked with, now being on that side of the table as opposed to the side of the table where they were pitching you. Have you seen the challenges that they're dealing with from a different point of view, or has it been kind of a straightforward, guys, I know from the days of when I was a marketer, you need to be talking to marketers like this, you need to be doing this, or have you kind of gone in the come in and gone, oh, okay, I see,
Yeah, to a certain extent, I should be paying them, because but don't tell them. I've learned.
I think you just need to be listening.
Never. No, I've learned as much out of this year. I've had an incredible year in that way. You know, a roller coaster, as with anybody starting their own business, right? But what a great year in terms of kind of meeting, you know, I've really got out into the industry. I've really enjoyed kind of meeting new people in the industry, learning about kind of the different parts of it. And yeah, it's been revealing to see the kind of, you know, lift the lid and see the struggles or the kind of, you know, the opportunities that they face, and then being able to apply that kind of different lens and that different mindset, which is about a kind of different background and experience and a different approach to problem solving, and as I say, a focus on kind of building genuine brands within the marketplace. There's very few out there. The people that have stood out for me, I think, as, you know, good marketers within the industry, Adobe, I mean, to a certain extent, I kind of sometimes hate their American theater that they, when they do the put in their shows. But you know, their Click Baby Click advertising, if you ever saw that, it's really, really good brand building content. It's absolutely brilliant. The Trade Desk with Media for Humankind is very good. Teeds, and as I say, kind of AdForm, I would say AdForm, but they are brilliant. You know, they are trying to build brands. They're trying to build distinction and differentiation within the marketplace. Those are the guys investing right now who will be there for the future. They're in there for the long term, and you know, they've got that balance between understanding short-term kind of lead generation and long-term demand generation. They've got that balance between building fame, which is, you know, it sounds kind of fluffy and kind of ephemeral, but fame is what makes a difference within kind of brand building right now.
Definitely seen that, particularly with the Trade Desk is a really good example of that in our industry. Everyone knows Jeff Green. You know, there's been definitely a real effort to kind of elevate not just their messaging, but the personalities within that business as well. Paul, we could just chat on and on and on and on, but we've run out of time, haven't we, Lindsay?
We certainly have. You're gone over, in
you're
fact.
You're the timekeeper.
Chatty bunch, you two, aren't you?
An hour and seven last week. Like, what do we do today? It was a long one, right?
Hour and five.
Can we just go on for another couple of minutes?
I knew get to you were going to say that as soon as I said that.
The competitiveness in me, that's really bad, isn't it?
I promise it won't impact your 2020 Ad Tech Personality of the Year campaign. Okay. I promise.
All right, done. Good.
Thank you very much for coming in and joining us on the podcast. And we'll have to catch up in 2020 anyway and have you back again.
It would be a pleasure. Good luck to you guys as
Thanks very much. Thanks for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast. Awesome.